to live righteously.
Hey, it's me, Richie T, and this is episode number 118 of The Cultural Hall, kind of a two-parter. In the second and third block, we talk with Melissa Moore, whose father was the Happy Face Killer. Murderer. Crazy story about that whole thing. And then here in the first block, I'm going to sit down with Jamie Lawson, who is the editor of LDS Living Magazine. So you can check that out. That's two parts in one. Two parts in one. Here we go. It's sitting down with Jamie Lawson from LDS Living. Hey, it's time for a special episode of The Cultural Hall. Today with us, we have Jamie Lawson, who is, for all intents and purposes, LDS Living. That's her.
That's me.
You've seen it online. Maybe you get the emails. I get the emails from you guys. We'll talk about that. You've seen a magazine as well. Jamie, she is the editor-in-chief. What's your title?
Managing editor.
Managing editor. I want to talk about LDS Living. For people who don't know, what are the different facets that you guys have?
Okay, as you mentioned, we have a very popular email subscriber list. We send emails 6 days a week that has different content in it, everything from the latest in Mormon news to family home evening lessons to lifestyle articles, things like that. We also have the website.
Which is LDSLiving.com. Okay.
Which has tons of content on there as well. And then we also have a bi-monthly print magazine that comes out six times a year.
Oh, it comes... Okay, bi-monthly. For some reason, I thought that meant twice a month. And I was like, no, wait a minute. I swear I don't see it that often.
No, but
Yeah, it's a January, February, that kind of thing.
Yes.
When did LDS Living come about?
It was founded in 2002.
Okay.
And it was an independent publication until Deseret Book acquired it a few years ago, and now we are a division of Deseret Book.
So it was someone's idea. They said, hey, you know what, this LDS Living thing is a great thing. We want to do it. And then Deseret Book said, yes, it is a good thing. We would like to purchase that.
That's right.
Who was it that started it?
It's a couple, Matt and Dina Kennedy.
Okay. Members of the church, I assume.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
They did a great job with it, developing it into something really successful.
Do you know much of their story? Like how they came about with the idea or anything like that?
I know that the original idea came from them looking at Martha Stewart Living and saying there should be a Mormon lifestyle magazine. And so they were filling a niche that way.
And so at that point, I'm assuming it was just a print publication? And then, or did they venture into online stuff?
They did.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then Deseret Book comes in, which means obviously that the LDS Church, because we own Deseret Book, that now the LDS Church owns LDS Living too.
Ultimately, yes.
So what kind of dynamic is that?
We do our own thing. We don't go through correlation or anything like that. We just try to be very responsible in the content that we create and always support what the brethren have said.
So like is there a, because I've often wondered this, because there are some things that you know, the Mormon folk want to talk about.
Yeah,
we run into this here in the Cultural Hall as well, where we're like, you know what, this is an issue that faces the church and we should talk about it. Things maybe like historical issues, or you know something of a sexual nature or something,
right?
Like that. And and we kind of discuss it within ourselves, saying, hey, you know what, is this, do we want to go here? How far do we want to go here? Is there a group of people, or is that kind of fall where you are LDS Living and the managing editor, you kind of give the compass?
We do that. We have our staff meetings where we kick around ideas like that. And then if we have something that we think is a little bit edgier but relevant to people, we'll take it to Sherry Dew, who is the CEO of Deseret Book.
So there is that sort of correlation where things have to kind of run through and by her?
Yes. Yes. We just want to make sure she feels good about everything that we're doing, because ultimately we're representing Deseret Book and the church.
So that's got to be kind of an interesting meeting, I would think, right? You come up with the whole issue or the whole email or whatever, and then go, here, has there ever been times where you're like, no, but we really need to do this, and kind of been kiboshed as far as that goes? Or maybe tone it down a little bit?
I think we're pretty careful with what we even bring to that level. You know, we're pretty good at knowing our audience and the line to walk. So we're not going to go in there with anything crazy.
It's interesting, too, the way that people assign the feelings or values of the Brethren of the Church based on its, you know, like, I guess where I'm going with this is KSL, which is a news station here in Salt Lake. It's owned by the church, ostensibly. And so when people, if they have programming on KSL on Channel 5 that is against, for lack of a better word, maybe church standards, you know, people really come down hard on the church saying, hey, how come the church is representing this terrible TV show? Now, sometimes they'll take TV shows off. And they won't share them. But they have shown and shared programming that people go, really? LDS Church? And I would think that similarly, too, that's why you have to be so careful with what you put out with LDS Living, because people would go, hey, that's not what the church thinks, or you're telling us something different than what the Brethren would say.
It is a line to walk, because we are not an official publication of the church.
Uh-huh.
We are just doing the best we can to talk about things that are relevant to Mormons, Mormon culture, issues that come up, like you said, things that maybe people have not wanted to talk about in the past. We did an article a few years ago on when a missionary returns early, mm-hmm. which was at the time a very taboo subject. And
sure.
I've seen more and more come around from that in the last few years. We've done articles on same-sex attraction and divorce and working moms and things like that. We acknowledge that not everyone has the perfect fairy tale life.
Yeah, which I think for a long time within the LDS Church, we were like, don't talk about it.
We're trying to start a productive discussion on things like that.
Yeah, and that's, you know, truthfully, that's one of the purposes we feel with the Cultural Hall as well. Everyone that's involved with the Cultural Hall, we're all, you know, faithful members of the church. We don't allow people to come on and say, you know, the church is false or it's wrong or we don't believe in it and any of that stuff. But we do certainly push boundaries and say, hey, you know, what about this? I think probably because we're entirely severed from the LDS Church itself, we can go further. But there are a lot of things that people really want to have the discussion about and don't have forums to be able to have that discussion. So it's valuable. And noticing where I followed LDS Living back when it was just, those folks before it was purchased by the church, mm-hmm. Have kind of seen that progression in how we went from super conservative to, hey, let's talk about some of these things. Are there things that you guys absolutely, you won't even touch as far as subject matter that you're just like, if it's a story about this, nope.
No, I mean, we don't have any hard rules right now. We'll consider anything.
Really?
But yeah.
That's awesome. What do you find to be the most popular, I guess, for lack of a better word?
Oh, it's really hard to say. People love to read about Mormon celebrities. Mm-hmm. Whether they want to admit it or not.
Yeah.
They love to read any kind of Hollywood connection. Right now on the current issue, the cover story is Mormons and Hollywood. And mm-hmm. 25.
Who are people just loving?
Like celebrities? Mm-hmm. David Archuleta, he was on our cover a couple of years ago, and that issue sold out. That is, I think, our most popular issue. We've had Jimmer on the cover. We've had Ann Romney on the cover.
Does it allow some credence or I guess do people take you a little more serious or give you the time of day, I guess, because you are sort of an arm of the church? Because with some of those folk, we've reached out to them as well. And we kind of get that, that's nice. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think we do have some credibility. We've been around for a long time. And now with being owned by Deseret Book, I think that gets us in a lot of doors.
Some of the ones that I think of, I know... you had a previous guest that we've had here in the Cultural Hall, and actually we got the idea, I think, to visit with her from you guys, is the Tattooed Mormon.
Oh, Al Fox.
Fox. Yeah.
Yes.
Who, a great episode. What an awesome story. But people can find that there. Are there features in the magazine that you'd like to point out to people if they're not familiar with LDS Living that you guys do every episode? Kind of tease people a little bit.
That we do every issue?
Yeah, or that you've done in the past and that would be a reoccurring thing. Like every January, February we do, that's our eating at home.
I actually don't like doing that.
Oh,
I don't like falling into formulas like that. We have a cooking section in every issue and a home entertainment section that tells you the latest and greatest entertainment products, you know, books and movies and
music.
On
those things, is it strictly LDS produced stuff, or is it, could it be like, you know, we found this really great movie in mainstream culture that would be safe?
We used to do that, but unless we have actually watched it or read it ourselves, we don't want to put it in on the off chance there's something in there mm-hmm. that is going to offend people. Mm-hmm. We don't want to recommend something unless we're very familiar with the product. But we have put in national products.
So you do home entertainment, you do cooking section. What else is in there?
Oh, we have in the back, very back page of the magazine, there's Inside the Numbers, which is just all these facts and figures, trivia that is related to one of the stories in the magazine. In the front, we have Short and Simple, which is just little fun tidbits and trivia, like history of the CTR ring or...
Oh, really?
A quiz about General Conference or just things like that. Just little finger reading, we call it, to lead people into the bigger articles in the middle of the magazine.
We joked earlier at the very beginning that you are the only person with LDS Living. How many people are on staff?
We are a small staff, but we've got six of us on the editorial staff.
Men, women, all women?
You know, currently we are all women. That's not intentional, but that's just
so
what it is
right
now.
So I just need to slide you my resume.
Yes,
hang
you
on
do.
Here.
Hand it over. Thank you.
Is that pretty fun?
Oh, we have a great time. We have a great team. We work very well together. People from different walks of life, which helps bring different perspectives, I think.
Old, young, that kind of thing? Or is it all kind of the same age?
I'm the oldest. I'll just say that.
And you're not old. I can tell by looking at you. You're not an old person. What's your training as far as this stuff goes?
I study journalism at BYU. Mm-hmm. So my emphasis was communications and print journalism. I don't know. Do you want my resume?
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah, no, I'm curious about it.
I worked for Reader's Digest back in New York before I was a stay-at-home mom. And
how many kids you got?
I have two boys.
Nice. How old are they?
They're 13 and 11.
Oh, aren't teenage years fun?
You know what? They're great. So far, so good. I love them.
Yeah, knock on wood. I've got an almost 16-year-old now. And the way he'll go from now 13 until he gets to 16, you will not recognize that kid, both physically and emotionally.
Right. I can see it happening already. Yeah.
So Reader's Digest, though, that's pretty... I mean, that's a great publication. Was that a pretty good time?
Oh, it was a great experience.
What did you do for them?
I did copy editing, and then I went over to copywriting.
That's
so
really
I worked
cool.
with their marketing department and wrote up for them.
So specifically, with being the managing editor of LDS Living, are you the one that kind of just oversees and everyone else writes, or do you also have to write as part of it?
I write a lot. Like, we're small staffed, and so it's everybody wears all kinds of different hats, and so we all jump in however needed. So I write quite a bit.
What's your favorite thing to write about?
I won't lie, I love to do high-profile people.
Yeah.
I think it's fascinating to get their experience in the spotlight.
Yeah.
And especially if they've been able to stay true to their testimony and be an example to other people.
Who's your favorite that you've had the chance to interview or talk to?
My favorite intrigueness.
Because that's actually, I'll tell you, the Cultural Hall started essentially based on that. We wanted to have audio interviews with high-profile Mormon people. Just
right.
thought to be able to hear people, because, you know, they're available in like the church news or you read about them in the Ensign or the newspaper even, but you never get to hear in their own words them describe kind of their experiences. So we went, well, here's the thing that, you know, not very many people are doing. Let's go out and do this. And then we quickly found that there's all these different facets of things that we wanted to talk about. So anyway, I was stalling so you could have a chance to think of.
Well, I appreciate that. No, that's tough. David Archuleta really was just a sweetheart, just a great interview. I love James Christensen, the artist. Mm-hmm. He's just a magical person and was just such a fun interview.
Do you guys have plans? I know with Elder Archuleta coming home pretty soon, is there plans to have him back in?
We'll wait until he's home before we talk about that. But always, you can't go wrong with David Archuleta.
Is there anything that to be done? And maybe I'm helping. Maybe I'm leading the magazine here. So,
feel free.
But there are a lot of rock stars, quote unquote, now who are Mormon and very uh-huh. strong in their Mormon faith. Has there ever been something done with that,
you know,
or
what?
Something
you're,
in the works?
You're scooping me. Right now, I'm in the middle of working on an article called Mormons Who Rock.
Yeah.
And, you know, Brandon Flowers,
sure.
Imagine Dragon, Neon Trees, Cascade.
Mm-hmm.
They're, like you said, they're, it's just
an explosion. I be in on those interviews, please?
If I can get hold of them and get them to commit, then absolutely.
We just recently had the opportunity to interview Elaine from Neon Trees, uh-huh. who is amazing. Return missionary and, you know, the drummer for the band, and just has an amazing story from, you know, being in the church and then saying, forget it, church, and then coming back and right. then serving a mission. And then as a rock star saying, hey, you know what? I want to have a family and taking time off to be a mom. And then now they've just re-released a new single and doing all that. She's a fascinating story. And I could help you with that.
Well, I would appreciate
that. A little back scratch one way,
thank you.
A little back scratch
it.
Another.
You got it.
So the one of the other things that I think is awesome that you guys do is you're meme crazy.
Are we meme crazy?
It seems like anytime I look at something online that's an LDS meme, there it's either you guys or the folks over at LDS Smile.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just to help get the word out? Is it just because you follow it as an internet trend, or
both? We can see what's popular, and people love memes. But also, it's a quick, easy way to share a good thought about. I mean, we like our humor as well, but you know, also around general conference time, we try to hurry and create memes and get them out there. It's just an easy way to share a little bit of the gospel.
And the church is focused on that a lot.
Yes.
Recently, using the internet for good, sharing the gospel through the internet, whether it be Facebook and, you know, all the things that the church has done. Is there something that you have wanted to do, either with the magazine or with the email or with the memes or whatever, that you have not yet done, that you're like, you know, we're hitting it, but I really want to. There's really this thing I want to do.
We're working on some stuff.
Oh, yeah?
That's all.
Yeah. All right, fine. I see what that was. That was a dodge.
It was a dodge. I don't know. Yeah, we're always looking for ways to take things to the next level and be as effective as possible.
What else was I going to ask you? There was if people want to subscribe to the magazine, they go to ldsliving.com and
yes,
they can.
There's a button there to subscribe.
How much does it cost?
It's $18.
A year?
For a 1 year subscription.
Can I get it sent with my ensign?
No.
No, separate, huh?
No, we're not.
I know. I'm just you're like, I need to make sure we keep
it
separate.
Don't confuse people.
But,
yeah.
Can I get it with my friend? No, I'm kidding. Is it something that you see that you'll do for the rest of your life? Or do you feel like, you know, there's a time and a season for it? And
the way I feel about it now is I love this job and I would love to stay. It's just such a rewarding job. It's interesting, fulfilling, and I love what I do.
Has LDS Living ever talked about doing an audio side of?
Yes, that's one of the things. Like we've dabbled in the occasional video and, mm-hmm. and looking at all of that stuff, you know, podcasts, digital versions of the magazine, and mm-hmm. all different ways to expand.
If you happen to go into the audio side, I know a guy that could do it.
Okay.
Just throwing that out there. Again, the resume here. Let's go ahead and toss that across the way. I think it's a great thing. I love it. I hope that it continues to gain just great success as people hear about it. And people can find it, ldsliving.com. You can subscribe to the email there on the website.
Yes.
Pretty obvious. Yes. I haven't looked because I just get it. I haven't looked to see how people can get it. And then it's every day but Sunday.
Yes.
Because the internet takes a rest on Sunday.
The people who create the emails take a rest on Sunday.
Okay. I've always wondered that because I noticed that they do come in every day but Sunday. But yeah. Sometimes I'm like, you know what? I wish I had the thing on Sunday because I like to take. Sometimes I'll save a couple of them and I'll read all the stuff on Sunday and to have that kind of current information on Sunday. But I get right. why the church would have to be like, meh, we're taking a day off. You guys are headquartered here in Salt Lake?
Yes, we're at Deseret Book Corporate Office.
Is that cool?
I love it. Great location. Right across the street from the temple. You can't get better than that.
So like lunch meeting, oh, let's go have lunch on the temple grounds today, that
yeah,
kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
Oh, see, that's what I need. That's what I need here. Let me ask you, as we ask everyone who steps into the cultural hall, just a few questions before I let you out of here.
Okay.
Do you have a calling in your ward right now? And if so, what is it?
Yes, I do. I am the Relief Society teacher.
Oh, yeah? How do you like that?
I love it.
Do you share teach or are you the only teacher?
I teach every second Sunday.
There you go. Favorite prophet to teach from?
Ooh, hard to say. I've only done Lorenzo Snow.
Do you have a favorite of the two?
Not yet.
I'm reserving the decision.
Yes.
Okay. If you could pick a calling for yourself or invent one, what calling would you pick?
I love this calling. Actually, I've always been in primary or nursery. This is my first experience with
With the grown-ups.
With the grown-ups, really. And I love being able to have a just an in-depth discussion about the gospel with members of the ward. It's great.
That's cool. Are you a crier?
I try not to be, but they'll rap me out. Yes, I can be.
It's funny how people weigh in on that, because there are some that are like, no, I love, you know, the emotion, you know, a teacher who can teach with emotion. And then I've met people who are like, if that person cries one more time
every
when
time.
They teach for crying out loud, yeah. You know, let's dehydrate you a little bit.
Exactly. No, yeah. I am not a constant crier, but it does happen on occasion. So.
And then what is your favorite part of your faith?
For me, my testimony is centered on the atonement, and I just love the hope that gives everyone. We should be the happiest people on the planet. Gospel the right way.
It's interesting that you say that, because, it's one of the things that I definitely anchor to is the atonement. It seems like as Mormons, we're super hard on ourselves, though.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if we truly understood the atonement, it'd be like, yeah, you bet. Woo! Mm-hmm. And instead it's like, oh, I'm not really doing.
I think a lot of us fall into the trap of, you can see everybody else, you know, of course it applies to you, but for me, it's, we are hard on ourselves. I'm hard on myself. I know that.
Yeah.
But I do. I think we fall into that trap quite often.
The last question, then I'll get you out of here. Sherry Dew needs to step in the cultural hall. Is there a way that you can arrange something like that?
I'll see what I can do.
All right. All right. So there you go. That's LDS Living in a nutshell. In an audio nutshell, that is. Coming up in the second and third block, we talk with Melissa Moore, the author, the survivor, the... The woman, it's a great story. Stick around for the second and third block. It's all about the Happy Face Killer. I didn't really know much about it. I've since seen a Lifetime movie about it. This is crazy. So check out this interview in the second and third block of the Cultural Hall.
We invite you to claim your courage by shedding shameful thoughts, actions, and feelings that disrupt your ability to live authentically or feel connected to others by letting go of fear, blame, and your idea of perfection. The Healing Group, where women go for hope, growth, and healing. We're the home of the Sex Girls. Are you a mother feeling lost in a relationship and feeling stuck? Are you feeling overwhelmed by life? Schedule an appointment now. Can't make it to our office? No problem. Meet with a therapist individually or with a group in our virtual clinic right from the comfort of your own home. Visit thehealinggroup.com for more information.
It's time for the second block of the Cultural Hall, and on the phone with us right now is Melissa Moore. Now, maybe you think of the B-list actress Melissa Moore. That's not who this is, though. If you Google search Melissa Moore, that's what comes up first. But we'll help her. We'll help this Melissa Moore get to the top of Google search. The way this interview came about was Jill went to theculturalhall.com and sent us this email. She says, I recently read a book that was written by a woman named Melissa Moore. She's an LDS convert who survived domestic abuse with a boyfriend and her mother's boyfriend. Her father is also the serial killer, the Happy Face Killer. I think it'd be a really interesting story to hear her story of survival, as well as what it was like to grow up with her father in prison for murder. I hope you look into it, Jill. So thank you for being on the phone with us all the way from Dallas, Texas. It's Melissa Moore, author of Shattered Silence. Thanks for being here, Melissa.
Thank you for having me.
So let us, just start at the very beginning. Growing up, where was growing up for you?
In Washington State is where I grew up, in a little town called Yakima, Washington. It's known for apples. You probably know it for treetop apples, and if you get apple juice, that's where your apples come from.
Oh, nice.
And so that's where I grew up, yeah.
Now, when you say small town, give me an idea of small town, because some people's small town is like Los Angeles.
Well, when I was growing up in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, it was really small. It's grown now considerably. So it would be probably like, I want to say like 100,000 people, maybe, max.
Okay, so yeah, nice, you know, pretty small, but not teeny town.
I mean, in this world, so I mean, spread out. So, it's like a little tiny mall, maybe, and one street of shops. It had like a Kmart, I remember that. So we had some big stores, but it's not like, you know, it's not like just a little post office. So it's more than that, but it wasn't anything spectacular, you know? not like the big city that I ended up moving to when I was 10, Spokane.
Okay.
And that is opposite of, on the Washington State, if you looked on the map and you saw Seattle, it's exactly across from Washington is Spokane, from Seattle on the map.
And so let's dive into it. So a survival story, abuse, all this stuff. Do you have siblings? Let's start there. Is it just you? Or?
I'm the oldest of three. So I was the oldest. And then there was me and then my brother, Jason, and then my sister, Carrie. And so we grew up in Yakima. We lived out in this area. And my dad, we didn't have an orchard at the beginning. My dad was a truck driver, a long-haul truck driver. And so he was gone a lot, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom, and he would just come home on the weekend. And he was really gregarious and fun, and he was a great dad, or so I thought, you know, growing up as a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought the world of him. I thought he was fun, and he was a boxer, and he was a cyclist. He was really a great dad as a kid. He had great stories from his long haul truck drives. He mostly went to California, like for produce, and bring it back. And so when he would come back on his long haul truck drives, he would have like pockets full of change for us kids, or like, so we'd run up to him and grab all the change out of his pockets. And then he would lift us up on his shoulders and, you know, like piggyback rides and play games. So, I mean, when you think of a serial killer, obviously you think of like really, you know, dark and lunatic or like devious mind, you know, you don't think of doting dad. So there was really two sides to my dad.
So, always gone during the week, but then would come home on weekends and never any sort of suspicion of anything other than just being fantastic dad.
At the beginning, and things started to turn darker as I got older. I started to notice things that were not so normal about my dad. You know, living out in the country, I didn't have access to a lot of people to see the differences with my dad, like a frame of reference to see how my dad was the same or different from mm-hmm. other dads. And, you know, obviously he traveled a lot, so I didn't have a lot of interaction with him. But when he was home and we would spend time with him is when I started to see, as I got older, some of the differences.
Differences like what?
The darkest moment as I got older was about when I was around 6 years old. And that's when I opened my book, Shattered Silence. That's probably one of the darker chapters is how I open it up, is to start the reader and people to understand that he really had two sides to him, and this was his dark side. And the dark side was this. I had found these kittens in the basement, these, you know, stray cats. The stray cat had a litter of kittens, and I decided to play house with them. And they were just fun, and I would play in the basement with them all the time, and I decided to bring them outside, to take them outside to play with them. And my dad saw what I had. And that's when things started to take a turn for the worse. My dad didn't like animals, and as we know about serial killers, that they kill animals or torture animals. And as a little girl, I didn't know that, obviously. And that's when he did the unthinkable before me, and he took my kittens and killed them in front of my siblings and I.
Oh, wait. So just like grabbed him and is like, here, I'll show you what I'm going to do with this, and just killed him, or just was like, hey. And then grabbed him.
Well, first,
you know,
he taunted it like it was actually fun for him. So, like, at first, you know, he looked like it wasn't going to be anything harmful. He had this look on his face like, well, he had a nickname for me. He called me Missy. And he's like, hey, Missy, what do you have there? And he obviously knew I had kittens in my hand. And then he took them by the tail. And then we had a clothesline, and that's when he proceeded to start hanging them up, and I was obviously pleading with my dad. He's 6'6" and about 300 pounds.
Oh,
you know, I'm a little tiny 6-year-old, and I'm like screaming, you know, jumping up and down, trying to get him to like take him down. And he hung them up on the clothesline. He's taunting them. He wanted to hang them up and see how they would claw. And he liked to see how they would fight for their survival. And he was getting a kick out of it. Like, he loved the like he liked the aspect, like he had a smile on his face, which was so odd to me as a child that he found it amusing and that he was enjoying this moment where I was having a pure panic, this was pure crisis for me. And so I wasn't getting any response from my dad, and the more I screamed for him to stop, the more he enjoyed it. So I ran into the house to grab my mom, and when I came back out, that's when all the kittens were on the dirt ground, you know, they were dead.
That was
one of the many experiences with animal abuse that I had growing up with my dad, and that's the time I realized that I couldn't trust my dad, that I knew that he was capable of something devious, something dark, something seething underneath the surface, that he was able to do something hurtful.
So how, even as a six-year-old, though, like if my dad was like, hey, your cat, I just killed it. Like, I think I wouldn't necessarily leap to serial killer as a six-year-old, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, I didn't make that leap either.
But to process just the fact that, like, you know, dad, superhero, I guess, in my mind, you know, I mean, that's how I kind of think of my dad. You know, he doesn't get sick. He, you know, he's this perfect person. And then something like that. I mean, how do you process it, or what, you know, what, how do you go on from that? That would be something that I'd be like, dad is now just crazy. Like,
yeah, that's what I started to question. I mean, there was something kind of, I knew there was something wrong with my dad, but I couldn't pinpoint, you know, as a child, how do you articulate that, and how do you articulate that to other people, especially when you see in the countryside, you see animals being killed all the time for purposes of eating.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
But this wasn't for eating at all. This was for entertainment. So it had a whole different kind of, you know, this was a whole different meaning. So, I mean, I would see my neighbors kill the turkeys for food for Thanksgiving. So it was a whole different purpose. And I could see the difference, but I didn't know how to articulate it. And then the fact that when I showed my mom, you know, when my mom came out and she reprimanded my dad, and there really wasn't, nothing really could happen out of it. Like, nothing really became of it. So it was just like, oh, that's what my dad does. And that's kind of just how it just kind of evolved later. Just like, that's what my dad does. And people seem to accept it. And so I thought I was the weird one because I thought it was off.
So when you say that your mom reprimanded him, was it like, hey, don't kill kittens in front of the kid? Like, I don't know. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, don't kill kittens in front of the kids. Like she was like, she yelled at my dad. I remember her yelling at my dad. And I remember her saying, like, hey, like, why are you doing it? Like, she was obviously disturbed. I remember her being disturbed by it and yelling at my dad about it. But, like, nothing, like, she didn't leave my dad over it. Nothing, we didn't pack our bags and head out the house. Like, nothing to that extreme. We still stayed in the house. It was just, that's what he does. That's what my dad does.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so now you just took, like, so that what happened to me, so what happened in that situation was it took an abnormal situation and kind of, like, framed it as almost kind of abnormally but normal. You know, like, kind of normalized it a little bit. Like, okay, it's not okay, but it's acceptable.
Oh, but that's how it is. So then, I mean, what next? Because that obviously, you know, as you're even able to describe detail for detail is something that impacted you. So then what's the mm-hmm. next thing?
So the next thing is, so as we, you know, years kind of go on, and so in my household with my dad and my mother, there wasn't a lot of fighting. It was more of no communication. My dad was chauvinistic and objectified women. There was a lot of verbal abuse, I would say, to my mother, like putting her down and her worth as far as my dad. And then there wasn't any physical violence, though. And there wasn't anything in that nature. So it was very shocking when, as the time went on, when I was age 10, my parents suddenly divorced. And I found out that my dad was having an affair with a waitress in California on one of his long-haul truck drives. He met a waitress in California, and he had moved her up to Washington State and was pretty much, you know, started another life with her and asked for my mother for a divorce. And so my mom packed some of our belongings and us children and moved us from Yakima, Washington, up to Spokane, Washington, to be where her family is, her mom. And that was really a blessing in disguise. At the time, it felt like my world was collapsing, you know, as a child, but it really was the best thing for me because it got me out of a situation where, you know, I was with my dad all the time, but secondly, I was able to be around other people to see what was normal. I mean, now we were from the country to a neighborhood where there was kids on every block. I mean, I was around tons of kids and around tons of people, so I can see what normal looked like.
Were there incidences with you? I know you mentioned that with your mom, there was never physical abuse, but certainly emotional abuse. Obviously, you know, things like killing pets in front of you is abuse, but were there issues of sexual or other types of abuse with you and your father?
Not with my dad, no. So my dad didn't sexually abuse me. He did strike me with a belt, like he would whip me with objects. And so there was physical violence with objects. And there is an incident where we had an electric fence and he wanted to teach me a lesson and had me and my brother a lesson and he had us hold an electric fence. So there's things like that. I know. So there are some things in the past. There was abuse. Yes, there was abuse in that sense. But the abuse started to escalate in a different way when, as I got older, it started to change. So I guess what is so tricky, I guess, about abuse is that there's this idea that if you're abused, it happens every day. And that's not the case. Like, abuse happens in events. It happens, like, it could be a one-time event. It could be, you know, it could happen three times in your life. It could be, you know, so when people say were you abused, and so sometimes I still have this mindset like, oh, you know, it happened a couple times. But in my mind, you know, I have this idea that if you were abused, it had to happen every day, but that's not really the case. It's
right.
Like, you know, it's not, it happens it's a couple incidences. So even with domestic abuse, as I'll get into with the story, my mom, so as we, you know, my mom and dad divorced in 1990, that's when my dad started to actually commit his first murder, after the divorce.
It was not until after your folks had got divorced that any sort of murdering had occurred.
As we know, yes.
Okay.
Everything on the record, everything on the court records, was 1990. It was right after the divorce of my parents. And he got unemployed, and he was living in Portland when he went into a bar, and he met a lady, and he had taken her home, and he got into an altercation with her, and that's when he had killed her.
Oh, geez.
And then, taken her body to a ravine in Portland, and I didn't know this, but he had taken her body and placed her at a place that our family would go to at a vacation spot all the time. And it wasn't until I was like, so when my parents divorced, my dad would pick us up on visitation and he would take us to different spots. And his favorite spot was always the Oregon coast, which this is the place where my dad had dropped off the body of his first victim, and that's when he said, when I was 13, he made a comment, like, I know how to kill someone and get away with it. On this visitation, you know, on this summer vacation with my dad after my parents were divorced. And that, you know, I have this memory from the past with my dad with the cats. And I, at this point, I just think my dad is, like, the weirdest dad in the world.
Sure, more than the common teenager who's like, geez, Dad, I hate you. It's
yes,
like, geez, Dad,
yes.
I think you're a murderer because you killed cats and you just told me that you know how to kill someone and get away with it.
So I'm 13 years old, and, you know, when a 13-year-old, those who are parents right now that have a 13-year-old or a teenager, and we all know, and I have a 12-year-old right now, and they can be kind of overdramatic, and so I would try to tell people about my dad that he is crazy, and they would think I'm just being overdramatic. They wouldn't get it. And I would try to articulate it, and they would just think that I'm just being an overdramatic 13-year-old, 12-year-old, you know. And I'm like, no, really, seriously, my dad is crazy. He's really weird. And so I try to talk to the counselors. I would try to, but as a kid, I really didn't know how to articulate this. It was very difficult too. How frustrating! Yes, it's super frustrating. Very frustrating, because there was no evidence. Like, I couldn't say, hey, my dad, you know, he says he killed someone and this is where the body is, because didn't know where the body was. He didn't tell me that, so I didn't have physical proof.
But did you really suspect at that point, at 13 years old, you know, my dad made this comment and I do remember the thing with the cats, I really think that he's killed someone, or was it just, I think my dad is crazy?
I just think my dad's crazy, and he's saying things. And so I told my mom, you know, I'd come home from our family vacations and I would, with my dad, and I would tell my mom, and I'd be in emotional distress, and she would just say, oh my goodness, I think we need to stop the visitation. And she was a single mom. She didn't have money to fight him in court to take away his visitation rights, so we would continue to have visitation with them. So it was just like a perpetual cycle. And then it would take about a month or so after visiting my dad for me to calm down, you know, emotionally. And so, but there was just nothing. Her hands were kind of tied in some ways to protect me from visitations, because there was no proof of anything. Yeah.
It's that side of innocent until proven guilty that you're just like, well, I think he's a major creeper. And there really isn't anything I can do about it. So long as he continues to pay child support, that's part of the divorce decree, and you have to go. What did your siblings think about that?
So they agreed, too. So they would have the same stories to my mom, and she agreed. And her hands were really tied. I mean, she would say, I don't want to, you know, have you guys go with your dad, but here on the flip side, so here's the catch-22. So my dad would pick us up and take us on these trips to the Oregon coast. You know, of course, we're having this emotional distress because he's saying, I know how to kill someone and get away with it. And then on the other side, he's buying all of our school supplies for the year. He's giving us everything we need, like, as a father, like, providing financially for us. And so it's very conflicting. Like, he's providing our temporal needs, but emotionally he's torturing us. So it's like, what do you do? You know, it was such a catch-22 for my mom. Legally, she had nothing really she could prove, because he's providing what he's supposed to as a father, and there was nothing she could prove emotionally, you know, or physically. He wasn't sexually abusing us either. So
all of this occurs, so then what's the next step in all this?
So the next step is, so he continues to just show up over the course of 5 years. So from 1990 to 1995, he would just show up randomly to our house in Spokane. In the meantime, you know, I wouldn't see him very often. My mom remarried, and this guy wasn't much better. So this man
wasn't much better than your dad.
Right. Right. I mean, he's not a serial killer, but he's.
Well, I mean, when you got the bar there, it's like, hey, mom, he's okay. I mean, at least he's not a serial killer, so that's fine.
Yeah. So, all right.
Yeah. Well, good work, mom.
Yeah, not a serial killer. So, all right. So, and you know, I have to say that, like, on defense of my mom, my dad left for another woman. She's emotionally pretty much destroyed.
Yeah, like just
her
devastated.
Self-worth is destroyed, devastated. I mean, she doesn't, obviously, we all don't know at this point that he's a serial killer, my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And all she knows is that my dad left her for another woman. She feels worthless. So she takes the first man that gives her attention, which is this other man. And he has left Colorado State. And his first marriage had failed due to, he was divorced due to domestic violence, and so when they got remarried, when my mom and him married, the cycle just picked up with my mom, and I knew something was up with this man, and as a child too, I couldn't articulate it. We went to counseling, you know, I go through all of this with the book. I tried to explain to the counselor what I don't like about him, but there really isn't anything I can really pinpoint. I just feel something is off about him. Things are adding up. Things are moving really quick. Like, I feel like he's forging the relationship really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And, but still, nothing solid or tangible that I can prove.
So you never saw this guy hit your mom or anything like that?
Not the beginning of the relationship. He's just forcing the relationship to move really fast to get married, and then moves into the house really fast. And I thought that was odd. Like, why is he in a rush to move into our house so quick?
He needs a place to live. That's why.
Yeah, he did. Because he was sleeping on the couch at a friend's house.
Yep.
Yeah. Exactly. You nailed it. So, so my mom becomes the primary breadwinner for not only us children, but for this man as well. And then over the course of time, it just builds into this horribly abusive relationship. And it just gets worse and worse. And it just wreaks havoc on our family to the point where he gets physically abusive to my brother. My brother leaves the house.
How old is your brother at this time?
He's around 16.
Okay.
And he leaves the house and pretty much is informally adopted by his best friend's family. And my dad is, you know, he's really out of the picture. So, you know, this is really hard on him. And we try to tell my dad about this man. And my dad's like, well, there's nothing I can do about it, you know. And, you know, we're just stuck. We think my dad's going to save us.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So,
Dad, murder our stepdad, Dad. Can you take care of this? We know you do it. You said you knew how to kill a guy.
Yeah, we don't know how this is going to work out for us. But, yeah, so the last time I see my dad, I'm in high school, and he picks us up, us three kids, and it's a spontaneous visit like it always is because he's a long-haul truck driver still. And it's a short notice. And so my siblings, they all had commitments with their friends and school activities, so they couldn't go to breakfast with my dad. But this was my first time alone with my dad for a long time, and so I go with my dad. And I go to breakfast with him at a diner downtown, and that's when he tries to tell me about the murders. And that's when I feel something's wrong. And I had this knowing that something was really off. And so I kept leaving to go to the bathroom, and I felt like I was going to throw up. I just felt sick.
Mm-hmm.
I went back to the table, and he said, you know, Missy, not everything is what it appears to be. And I have something really important to tell you.
Oh, geez.
But you'll tell the authorities. And I thought, well, I had heard rumors that my dad had stole things in the past at his previous work. He used to be a welder back in Canada when I was a little girl, and that was so long ago, you know, so I heard about that, and I remember hearing lessons from my dad about stealing and that you shouldn't do it, and then I thought maybe that came from
your mind automatically doesn't go to like any sort of violence or anything. It automatically goes to this thought of stealing or that he's taken something. Okay.
Yeah, it goes to that. And then, so ironically, you know, my dad was all about honor and about like not stealing and not smoking and, you know, drugs and how you present yourself and about health and about fitness and everything important about our last name and keeping it not a disgrace in public.
Yeah. Take some pride in your last name. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And, so he's like, well, you're going to tell the authorities. And so this is quite a shock to me. I'm like, tell the authorities, like, what did my dad do? And so that's why I went to that old story, that old rumor. So I thought maybe it's that old story coming that he's going to tell me finally about this rumor story. And like, why would he tell me about it now? But I felt so sick about it. So I said, what, Dad? You know, tell me. It's okay, Dad. Just go ahead and tell me. Thinking it's from the past. And he said, you know, no, I want to tell you, but you'll tell the authorities. And that's when I just felt this energy around, like this anxious feeling in my gut, this knowing feeling like I got to just get out of the table, like leave this area around my dad. And so I said, I got to go, Dad. And I went to the restroom and while I was in the bathroom, I just kept thinking, like, what is wrong with me? Why can't I just handle a conversation with my dad? Thinking like it's just something innocent, you know, that he was going to confess to me about stealing or something small. And why do I always feel anxious around my dad? Why do I never feel comfortable around my dad? I started having memories of every time he would visit, he'd always, or camping, he'd always, you know, try to be affectionate with me, like cuddle with me and stuff. And I would just felt uncomfortable around him. Unsafe is really the word. Unsafe around my dad. And not knowing why exactly. And so I went back to the table finally when it subsided and our food had arrived and the conversation went almost to like a ominous kind of tone, like he started talking about the future as if it's not going to happen. And I remember he would take that tone when he would have conversations with me in the past about when he would have thoughts of killing himself.
Okay.
And he would call us sometimes to say, you know, when he would have these ideas in his mind that he was going to kill himself, when he would drive by the prisons, he would say, and like honk his horn, his truck horn, because he thought he was going to be there someday. And now it all makes sense. Like, all the puzzle pieces are coming together.
Yeah.
That he knew it was all going to catch up to him eventually. And he knew that the end was coming close to his spree of murders. And I think he was, in a way, trying to warn me, but realized that I would have to tell authorities. I don't know what he imagined telling me would be like, but I'm so glad he didn't, because now that I think of it, I don't know how that day would have ended. Like,
right.
I would have to go tell my school counselors or like call 911, or how would he drive me back to the high school? How would that drive then? I have no idea.
You're not going to tell anyone, are you? No, Dad, I swear. Just get me back to the school. Just give me back.
Yes, please just give me back to the school. Please, Dad, please.
Yeah, no, we're good. Just give me back.
Yeah, like that would have been a total Emmy award-winning act, you know, getting back to the school. I would have deserved an Emmy for that one. Yeah, that would have been, I don't know. I have no idea. So I just feel like that was, my life was spared completely on that one.
So he doesn't tell you. He takes you back to the school, and now you're like in your mind going, well, my dad's done something illegal that he can't tell me about. You know, stepdad is beating my mom. I mean, this is a lot for a teenage kid to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so, you know, life just kind of goes on from there. And then the news breaks out. Like, it just, then I get into an abusive relationship, which goes into details in the book and stuff. because I'm mimicking, you know, what happened in my home. And then I break out of that relationship, but I'm in that relationship when the news breaks about my dad.
Okay.
And the how I find out is the news airs my dad in an orange jumpsuit, all over. I mean, it's just broadcast everywhere. Because he's called the Happy Face serial killer because he was writing notes to the Oregonian paper and giving clues about that first murder that I talked about. Another couple had confessed to the murder, and they had been sentenced to prison. And my dad was trying to release them from prison, saying that they weren't the guilty ones, that he was.
Come on,
and
it was me. So it was me. Don't let them take credit.
Exactly. So he would sign on bathroom stalls around the nation, and to the Oregonian paper, he would sign a smiley face instead of his name, because, of course, he doesn't want to admit his name, but he would tell them clues and tell them where you can find this belonging or that belonging. And so finally they were starting to realize, oh my gosh, we might have arrested and sentenced the wrong couple. And then they started to realize we might have a serial killer on the loose here. And so it just became national news. And then, you know, they started to track other bodies. And then just once they captured my dad, which I have my dad actually ended up turning himself in because with the last victim happened to be his fiance, and he wrote on the car deed his name, and so they were on his trail, and so he thought he was going to commit suicide, and so he wrote a confession letter to us kids and to my uncle, and so I have that confession letter in the book about what he writes, and so he essentially thinks he's going to be dead. No one's going to, you know.
Yeah, essentially get away with it because he's going to take his own life.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So he's, like I said in the beginning, he's 6'6", 300 pounds. He doesn't give himself the proper dosage, so he's still alive.
Ugh.
He ends up just taking a really good nap. So he ends up living, and they capture him. He goes to jail. It makes headlines around my area, the Pacific Northwest. I don't know about the nation. I don't know, but in my world, it does.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone at my school, my high school, knows about it. And it pretty much ruins my world, you know, as a high schooler. It just, like, I'm guilty by association.
Sure.
So that's when it started to become a really big secret. After that, I changed schools. I changed my life. I tried to avoid anything about my dad, and I wanted nothing to do with the topic of my dad. Over time, it became a secret. And, you know, at the beginning, it wasn't. People knew, but over time, it faded away.
It's like, your name is Melissa. Yeah, last name. My dad is not a serial killer. Okay. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Let's just keep that.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
So over time, I just try to create as much distance as possible until 2008, when, you know, now I'm married. I mean, that was awkward, like dating, and then, oh, you know, you want to meet my parents?
Let's see.
There's something I have to tell you.
So let's stop real quick. So dad goes to prison, federal prison, I assume, or is it state prison in Washington?
It's in actually Oregon.
Oh, Oregon.
Because it was on the Oregon side.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, state prison in Oregon, and mom continues to be married to the abusive gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you're dating. It's like, well, okay, let me talk about my parents real quick. Dad's in jail, so we can go see him there. And mom is in an abusive relationship. That seems really difficult. I would think you'd just kind of distance yourself completely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there was no topic of, like, my dad. So that they started bringing up in, you know, dating conversations, like asking about, you know, about my parents, it'd just be whatever I could do to avoid the topic,
mm-hmm.
you know, whatever. And I kind of felt like I was duping the poor guys, like, what they don't know what they're kind of getting into.
Sure.
But but then I fell in love with Sam, my husband. So now that, so I actually met him at a church dance.
At an LDS church dance?
Yes.
Okay.
So going forward, I go to college.
Where'd you go to college?
I went to college at a community college for cosmetology and to get my AA degree. And it just happens to be, which I tell in the book too, that along the whole time, all of my friends and the people that supported me were LDS.
Hmm.
And I just adored them. They comforted me. Their homes were so inviting. I felt peace in their homes. It was a sanctuary for me from the havoc, just the craziness of my life. And so I really enjoyed being around their parents and their homes and going to their functions. And so in college, again, this girl ends up coming into my life that's LDS, and she invites me to go to a Mormon dance. And
we're going to hear all about the Mormon dance here. We're going to take a break for just a second, and we'll come back, and we'll talk all about how you meet your husband at that Mormon dance, all right?
All right, sounds good.
All right, that's coming back in the third block here of the Cultural Hall.
Sidewinder Media was named as one of Utah's top photographers by In This Week magazine and is a winner of several awards for fine art, portrait, and event photography. Sidewinder Media has been professionally photographing everything from wildlife to headshots for over 10 years. Sidewinder Media has the experience and the knowledge to capture your special occasion or portrait the way you want it. They also film and edit music or product videos and do simple ads for Facebook or websites. Email them at sidewindermedia@gmail.com or call Rusty at 801-941-5576 to book your shoot today.
Running a small business today can be difficult enough. Imagine all the work you have to do to market it. Imagine the hours you put in to create promotional materials for it. Now, imagine a partner that can help you with all of that and more. Imagine Lennon Design. Lennon Design is your partner in business when you need a professional look at a price you can afford. Whether it's websites, advertising media, promotional materials, and more, Lennon Design can help you promote your business. When you need creative, affordable designs, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
All right, it's the third block of the Cultural Hall. We're joined by Melissa Moore, who is the author of the book Shattered Silence. Her father is the Happy Face Killer. You can hear all about that in the second block if you're joining us just here for the third block. And you are about to meet your husband, all of your friends that supported you through your family ordeal, LDS folks, and now you're about to meet your husband at an LDS. Now, I'm guessing it's an institute dance because you're college age, yeah?
Yes.
So love at first sight. Let's go. Let's do it.
Yeah. So this is my first Mormon dance, and I remember going with my friend, and she just kind of ditches me. She's dancing with all these guys, and I look over and I see Sam, my now husband, sitting on the stage, and I see him. I'm like, okay. So I'm just go talk to this guy over here, and so I go and sit with him, and we just have this conversation. It's natural. And I remember the thought went through my head, which was so strange, thinking, this is the guy you're going to marry.
What?
And that has never crossed my mind ever. So I'm in my 20s at this point, and I was about ready to go to California because I was in college studying cosmetology. My dream was actually to work in L.A. for studios. Mm-hmm. And to do makeup and hair for TV shows. And so I got an invite to go move to Hollywood with a friend and to start that. And so when I met this guy, and the thought just went through my head, this is the guy that you can marry. Like, this guy is it. I'm like, I'm going to leave. I'm going to California. This, you know, logically, that doesn't make sense. But yeah, this guy was wonderful.
This isn't part of the plan.
Check mark, everything that I wanted in a guy. He was smart. He wore his heart on his sleeve. Like, he was just intellectual.
He wasn't a murderer, which was nice.
He wasn't
abusive. That was nice too.
Yes. Yes. You could just tell. Like, he was totally trustworthy. And so what surprised me is that he didn't ask for my number or anything. Like, he didn't seem interested in me. So I was like, oh, okay, never mind. So
fine, I guess I won't marry you then, whatever.
Yeah, I guess not. And so so I asked my friend about him, like, hey, that's strange. Like, he didn't seem very interested at all. Like, you know,
and she's
non-LDS dating world, I would just, like, they would just get their number. It was so different. I thought, well, maybe Mormons, like, date differently or something. But I didn't know his backstory. So his backstory was he had just ended in a relationship. So he was just kind of cautious. So I didn't know that. So, and he didn't know, he could tell I wasn't, that I wasn't a member. And that wasn't the reason why he didn't give his number. But he was just being, like, he just wanted to find out more information about me from my friend.
Sure.
So he just
a little guarded.
Guarded. Yeah. And, you know, so the news had already broke to him about my dad. So that's why, you know, he hadn't heard that yet either. So that's good. I'm glad he didn't know that. And
he's like, I could handle the dad being a murderer thing, but the dad being a murderer thing and the non-member thing, too much. That's too much for me to handle.
Yeah, that would be his parents.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So that they actually, they supported me as a, okay, so they supported me as a person.
We support you just fine, but you're
a missionary.
Yep. Yep. I know where this is going.
Yeah. He's a return missionary, and so I'm not a member, and I wasn't taking I wasn't investigating the church.
Uh-huh.
And my mom had heard that the Mormon church was a cult, and, like, all these other things, like, all these different beliefs about the church, and so she was very scared about me even taking the discussions, and so she didn't really want me to pursue the faith at all. And his side of the family was like, who is this lady? We need to know more about her. So we were just friends. So mm-hmm. We just decided, let's just be friends.
Let's put the marriage thing on the back burner for a little bit. Let's just be friends.
Exactly. So the whole summer, that was around Easter time. And so from Easter forward, we were just friends, and we would just go and do things together as groups and do things. And we were just magnetized to each other. We had so much fun. We couldn't get enough of each other's company. And he fell in love with me, and I fell in love with him, and we decided to get married civilly. And we got married at the Bozarth Mansion in Spokane. And that was a beautiful ceremony. And then we welcomed our daughter Aspen into the world. And then after I had my daughter is when I realized that I really wanted her to grow up with a faith in God. Like, I wanted her to believe in God, and I wanted to teach her about God, but I realized I didn't really know that much about God.
Yeah.
And so I asked my husband more, and then I was more open to it. And so I started taking the discussions. And what was the final piece for that was when I heard the story of you coming to the ancient, to the ancient Americans, and just showing his hands, and then I realized that this might be the true gospel, and so I was open to being baptized, and that was kind of like when I joined the church, which was 10 years ago.
And the parents, then his parents, finally at that point, they're like, "Oh, phew." Big sigh of relief, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they, you know, they came to know me and to like me, and they love me now, and they're family to me, and his sister is family to me, and yes, they totally welcome me.
Let me ask you. Was it sort of frustrating, that whole religious, almost bias that came from his parents?
Yes. It gave me cold feet. It I had a moment in time I'll never forget right before we were to be married where I almost called the wedding off because I realized that I was marrying not just him but his family.
Sure.
And I know that's so crazy because here I have a dad who's a serial killer. You know, like he's doing the same to me too.
He's like, I'm taking a leap here too, pal. So it's not, just you.
Yeah, we're marrying each other's families here. I mean, so, you know, I'm not... And what's so crazy is that they weren't judging my serial killer dad. They were judging my religion.
Uh-huh.
And more than they were judging who my father was. So, and the past and the fact that we wouldn't be getting married in the temple and the fact that that was really hard. And
it's hard because it's missing the point. That's the thing that I think is so frustrating. Do you love each other? Yes. Do you, do you feel like you could be separated from each other? No, probably not. Do you support each other in what you want to do? Okay. Well, then maybe you'll end up being a member of the church later. Maybe you won't. But at hearing stuff like that, those kind of stories just drive me crazy because it doesn't help the individual and it doesn't help the image of the church and it doesn't help anyone to be like, well, I'm not sure that that's the right thing. It's love everyone.
Yeah, so what I think, if I'm going to be candid here, is that the more that they pressured me, the further I went away. So had I been, if it was an open space where there's like, we love you as you are, we're not going to force you down this path, I would have been more open to it, especially like right after we had our daughter Aspen. They talked about baby blessing, and I write about it in the book, and I didn't know about baby blessings. I thought that meant if we gave her a baby blessing, she would automatically be a member of the church, like it is in the Catholic faith, like
mm-hmm.
When you're baptized. Because I was raised up in the Catholic faith, and when I was baptized, I became, confirmed into the church.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have that knowledge of my background of my faith, and I kind of presumed it into the Mormon faith, which is my bad. That's my wrong.
Sure.
And instead of asking questions, and she's like, oh, are you, I didn't ask these questions to her, and I should have. She's like, are you going to have your baby blessed? And I was like, no, of course not. I'm not going to have the baby blessed. And so that was wrong of me for not asking questions because my defense was so high from the beginning of our area. So I wish I would have been more open, at the beginning to ask more questions instead of assuming things.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, I'm so glad that it has mended. And now I have this rich experience of I've known what it feels like to have gone through that. So I can help people that have, non-member family members and member family members. I can understand what they're going through.
The other thing that I think it does too is that, and unfortunately people will say or hint or think this, is that sometimes when you have the couples where, one is not a member, but then they join immediately or join right before they get married, like wrongfully question the intention of the person. It may very well be their spiritual journey led them at that time before or just after they got married to become a member of the church. But as other members, I feel like a lot of people look at that and go, oh, well, she's just doing that because that's what her husband wanted her to do. But, doing it the way you did it, that journey allows you to have that thing where it's like, no, I love him. We have a daughter. I love her. And then of your own choice, decide to come into the church.
Yeah, it's different for everybody. And what I'm so glad too is like, so with his sister, is that so she married a non-member, and he joined. He took the discussions and joined the church,
mm-hmm.
and so they welcomed him really fast. So I think I kind of was the pioneer for the family. So, but he's still a member. So, and he loves the church and he I mean, he's the only member in the family. And so what I would say to members who think that if someone's joining the church just to get married, that's, that they're probably not looking at the full story, because a lot of times when you join the church, you're losing so much sometimes of the support of your family or the support or any, or you're getting criticized or you're losing things a lot of times to join the faith.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are some sacrifices people do make to join the church. I mean, for me, it's like, you know, you're not drinking coffee, you're not drinking alcohol. So even that, I mean, those are, might be little things to some people, or they might not look at it as a big sacrifice. But for members who have always, or for people who have always drinking Starbucks or coffee, I mean, that's a big sacrifice to some people. For me, it was. So, you know, I think that if they choose to join a religion, anybody, if that is to join the Jewish faith, if that's joining any faith at all, if they choose to join the faith and convert to a faith for marriage or in general, or for any reason, it signifies a real, you know, a real desire.
Melissa, I only have just a couple more minutes with you, so I want to let people know the book Shattered Silence. You can get it at all your regular places. You can find it online. It's Melissa Moore with an O-O-R-E. That's how you can find her. She's not the B-list actress. Do you get that sometimes?
I haven't yet.
Oh.
That's
well,
so funny. No, not yet.
Well, then consider it now. I just did it.
Okay.
people can find it there. You can get it in the bookstores, everything like that. I do have one question that you didn't cover. You said that your husband at the time that you met him did not know about your father. How did you tell him?
Oh, I told him right before we even started talking about marriage. It was when things started to get serious in a relationship. I told him on a date. And after I told him, I told him a little bit, and that's when he was, you know, he percolated on it, and he was kind of shocked, of course. And I expected him to pretty much run away from our relationship, and he didn't. He wanted to know more, so I just gave him the space to Google it and to, like, do his own research on it. He's been so supportive. I mean, he's really a foundation for me, my best friend. I mean, he's everything to me. We've been married now for 13 years.
It's funny, as my mind kind of muses on these things, I see the two of you out at dinner at, you know, local restaurant, insert whatever that is. And, you know, the waiter's like, hey, can I take your order? Oh, yeah, sure, I'll have this salad. My dad is a murderer. And Sprite to drink. And he just kind of looks over at you and goes, what? Wait, what? You know, just this kind of thing where he kind of trying, you know, you're downplaying. Listen, it's no big deal. I just want to clear the air before we get too serious, because I like you,
well,
and I know you like me.
Yeah, it's funny you said murderer, because, like, that's what I said, is I said he's a murderer versus serial killer, because, like, that never rolls off your tongue very well. Like,
yeah.
It seems to, like, it's easier to say murderer than serial killer. Like, he's a murderer and versus serial killer. It just, so that's how I, so you're so right. I did say murderer. I'm like, he's a murderer. And he's like, what? So you're right. And then I had to say, oh, how many murders? And then I had to say, 8. But he's confessed to 160 something.
Yeah.
You know, like that. That's been, yeah, it's shocking.
Like the bright side of that whole thing is, it's like 8 that he's been convicted of, though, huh? He's admitted to 160.
That's a silver lining.
Hey, you want dessert? Should we get dessert? Are you full?
Yeah. Oh, you have to leave now? Oh, I'm sorry.
Hey,
our date ended early.
All right, I'll go ahead and take the check. It wasn't what I said, was it? Was the food not any good? What's going on?
Yeah, I really did think I was going to be single for a long, long time. I didn't know I was actually, I really didn't think I'd get married, ever. So that's why I did plan on moving to Hollywood and to California and working in the industry and doing hair and stuff, because I really thought that the whole family life wouldn't probably be mine because of what my father, you know, the life that my father chose and the impact it would have on me. And so surprisingly, you know, when I came forward and then my book when I appeared on Oprah, and I got dozens of letters. So there's actually, so I'm actually not the only daughter of a serial killer. There are so many more than just me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I got tons of letters afterwards of family members of violent criminals, but not just that, but just letters of people wanting to know how they can heal after violence or trauma. And so it just got me to go on this quest and to see what I can do to help other people.
And you can read more about it. I'm sure we've just barely touched on, you know, a small, small portion of what's in the book. Shattered Silence is the name of it. Melissa, before I let you go, we have three questions that we ask everyone who steps into the cultural hall. The first one is, do you have a calling in your ward right now? And if so, what is it?
I do. So people report their visiting teaching to me. So I don't know what the name of that is.
Visiting teaching coordinator, I think, something like that.
Yes, that is it.
If you could pick a calling for yourself, either one that exists or one that you get to make up, what would it be?
I love the young women. I've served in young women before, and it would be fun if I can make up a calling or serve in a calling where I could travel the world and speak to young women.
Perfect. And then the final question that we ask everyone who steps here into the cultural hall is, what is the favorite part of your faith?
Personal revelation.
And why?
I love that we can have personal revelation, I love that part of our religion too. I love that it endorses that we can speak to God and that we can pray and receive answers.
Well, we hope that the show has nourished and strengthened your body, and that if you weren't healthy enough to listen this week, that you'll be healthy enough to listen next week, and that you'll travel home safely when the time comes. In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you on the back row of the Cultural Hall.
Save me a seat. It's sure to be neat on the back.